Call the next case.
You may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Norman Thomas, and I represent Mr. Nicholas Secret in this appeal. Mr. Chief Justice, I would like to reserve 3 minutes.
3 minutes.
It is our position that when the trial court made a finding that Mr. Secret had, that the Commonwealth had failed to present any evidence that the Mr. Secret specifically intended to kill any person individually, and then followed that up within a couple of pages of the transcript with finding that he had no specific animus against any one of the individual people, and those people being members of Acorn community, that it therefore made dispositive findings, which required as a matter of law that the attempted murder charges or the indictments be dismissed. The court followed that finding up with one that said, well, he basically intended to kill all the people that were there. And we've taken the position throughout the litigation that that finding was mutually exclusive of what he had just found in terms of Mr. Secret lacking a specific intent to kill, which is a necessary element of attempted murder.
But the conviction, of course, is a conviction, and we've so often said that arguably aberrant remarks from the bench have to be contextualized to the result. So it's hardly possible the trial court was actually saying, I find no mens rea, but I'm still going to convict him. Isn't it more likely that in context, the best and most reasonable inference is he didn't know who he was trying to kill, but he was trying to kill them all?
It cannot be reconciled in that way, and that's our position. Mr. Secret is the one that's saying, look at the words in their context. Look at the words actually used. And while the court made a differentiation between the people that were there and the people that weren't, when the court made the finding that there was an absence of evidence of specific intent to kill, we're talking about the same people. It's the people of the Acorn community at Hartwood at 5 in the morning on October 12, 2013.
I thought we were talking about a subset of the whole community, and no one could figure out whether the defendant knew who was in the subset, but he did intend to include the subset in his intent to kill.
Well, the court said, first, before we get to the question of who was there and who wasn't there, does the Commonwealth take the position that they can prosecute Mr. Secret for attempted murder, regardless whether the people were there or not? And it was in the context of that conversation with the Commonwealth's attorney that the court said, but we don't have any evidence that he specifically intended to kill any person individually, and also that there's no evidence that he had specific animus toward anyone.
Isn't in context the trial judge simply saying, I don't know if he had a beef with one particular guy or one particular woman, but his conviction is, but I know one thing, he tried to kill them all.
That's not what the court said, Your Honor. Respectfully, that's not what the court said. It said he doesn't have any specific intent to kill any person individually, and that he had no malice towards any given person. No animus was the word he used toward any individual of the Acorn community. And our position has been all along that if we're talking about the same group of people, Acorn members, at the same place, Hartwood, at the same time, then those two statements are mutually exclusive statements.
But this
cannot be reconciled.
It's a jury trial, right?
It is a jury trial.
So, I mean, we're looking at a motion to strike issue. We're not looking at a bench trial remark during the result in the case. The trial judge is not making factual findings. The jury is.
Well, actually, Your Honor, the court is being asked at the motion to strike not to send it to the jury at all, to make dispositive findings at that point in time.
And he's not allowed to do that. He's not allowed to make any factual findings. He's only allowed to address the rationality of the inferences that the moving party has asserted, in this case the Commonwealth.
Well, Your Honor, our position is that the court is able to establish at that point in time as a matter of law whether the Commonwealth's evidence makes a prima facie case of attempted murder, attempted first-degree murder, against Mr. Secret with respect to these indictments. And at that point in time, it made findings that necessarily required it to sustain the motions to strike.
My last point here, isn't that right result long reason? He denied the motion to strike. There obviously was sufficient evidence for attempted killing. He made an aberrant remark. Okay, the appellee comes on appeal and says it was arguably an aberrant remark, but he made the right decision. And then from there is the jury's call. You're not saying that the jury could not have inferred intent to kill, or are you?
Well, we're saying that the trial court found he had no specific intent to kill, and well, as a matter of law, it never should have gone to the jury.
Suppose the trial court didn't say that. Would you be arguing the jury could not infer the intent to kill under these facts?
If the trial court had not found an absence of evidence regarding specific intent to kill, no, we couldn't make the same argument.
Okay. So.
But here we are left at the very best. Even if you take the duality of the two statements, at the very best, the trial court has found that there's a reasonable hypothesis of innocence that hasn't been excluded. The evidence is in equipoise at that point in time based on those findings as to one that's consistent with guilt and one that is consistent with innocence. And we submit, Your Honors, that on this particular point, Mr. Secret is asking that the words and the context be found exactly as the trial court said them. We're not, this isn't a cherry-picking or a reinterpretation or a rephrasing. The court will agree with us or disagree with us on this point, but our point is that the trial court made a dispositive finding, notwithstanding the fact that it then turned around and sent it to the jury. I do want to speak about the interrogation tactics here, and I'd like to begin the analysis on that topic with respect to the Elstat case. In Elstat, the U.S. Supreme Court gave police a great deal of latitude to cure an error, be it mistaken, be it innocent, however it came along, but to cure an error in giving Miranda rights in the first part of what amounts to an in-custody interrogation. And it prescribed the cure for that. It said there must be a careful and thorough administration of Miranda warnings to cure the conditions that render the initial statement inadmissible and involuntary. And in this case, not only do we say that there was not a careful and thorough administration of Miranda warnings, but we also contend that the record establishes a very definite use of coercively exploitative tactics at the time the rights waiver was given.
How do you deal with the fact that the governing law is Kennedy's concurrence and Siebert, and that's a fact question? Deliberateness is a fact question. Well, and this trial judge extensively analyzed every inference and made a factual finding.
With respect to the Siebert analysis, we do say that the trial court was incorrect, that the evidence did not support its finding on deliberateness. But I want to expand on that. If we're going to transition over to the Siebert question, understanding that this court has not made an election between the plurality decision in Siebert and the Kennedy concurrence, but understanding, too, that there may be, as there is across the country, a great momentum under the Kennedy concurrence to accept that as the law.
But the U.S. Supreme Court's made an election. They've said over and over again, when there's a plurality opinion, in this case concurred in result only by the concurrence, not in any other way, concurred in result only, that the governing opinion is the narrower of the two.
We don't argue with that.
Okay, so if we were to go with the the plurality in contest with the Kennedy opinion, we would be violating the U.S. Supreme Court's own instructions on how to read their cases.
Although many courts in other states have chosen to go with the plurality under their own law and their own interpretations, we don't argue with that. Our position is that whichever methodology of analysis is done, the concurrence of Kennedy or the plurality, that this conduct, the willful ignorance that Agent Lazier forced on himself, his conscious willingness to ignore all the facts that lay before him as to the reality that Mr. Secret was in custody, falls within the ambit of Justice Kennedy's own words that Lazier acted in a way calculated to undermine the Miranda warnings. And in fact, even in the Kuhn case decided by the Court of Appeals of Virginia, it spoke in terms of deliberateness. And many courts have interpreted Justice Kennedy's words as pure deliberateness. But in fact, the words are broader. They include any police conduct that's conducted in a way to undermine the Miranda warnings.
But he specifically, in using the very words, said he rejected the plurality's use of an objective standard.
Yes, he did.
So, I mean, that tells us it's a subjective standard, and that tells us it's a question of fact. And now the only issue, if that logic is right, is could a rational fact finder conclude from this evidence that the officer did not intend with malice aforethought to manipulate Miranda?
Well, the court did not, first of all, if you look at, for example, Landrum versus Chippenham Hospital, the court did not give weight to the willful ignorance. It looked only at the deliberateness aspect of it. And our position is that the words of Justice Kennedy are broader than just deliberate. But it has to be conscious, and our position is that Agent Lazier's behavior was conscious. He didn't want to know anything. If he had used that 5 minutes that he was there, that he says he was socializing with the other members of law enforcement community to find out if anybody had placed Mr. Secret in custody, he would have found out, in fact, as the trial court found, that it was obvious that he was in custody.
But that's not the issue. We don't even talk about Miranda if he's not in custody.
But he was in custody.
I know. That's not the point, though. We wouldn't be having a discussion like this if he weren't in custody. The question is, was Miranda deliberately, with intent, manipulated to produce a two-step process by an officer intending to do it? And the trial court said no, looked at all the facts, and the officer did not have that intent.
And we argue, in counter to that position that the Commonwealth has taken in this case, that conduct by police or law enforcement officials in a way calculated to undermine Miranda can be broader than simple deliberate use of the tactic. It can be a conscious use of a tactic that does the same thing in that it's calculated to undermine Miranda. And we also argue that Kuhn recognized that on page 91 of that 61 Virginia appeal. And we also state in the case of Bobby versus Dixon that the U.S.
Help me understand the gap between a conscious act and a deliberate act, because those seem awfully close to me.
They are very close together, Your Honor. Our position on that is simply, as I've stated, that deliberateness is one thing, but conduct conducted in a way that will undermine the Miranda warnings can be something other than a deliberate choice to engage in a two-step interrogation.
And that would be consistent with the plurality, but inconsistent with the governing concurrence.
We say our position is that it is consistent with the concurrence.
Would you like to save the remainder of your time?
I would, yes.
Good morning. May it please the court, Robert Anderson for the Commonwealth. Let me address the issues in the same order as counsel. First, on the sufficiency of the evidence, I think the argument, first of all, ascribes far too much weight to this one isolated remark, and it also doesn't really give effect to a very well settled principle of this court. They said this in the Yarborough case, where the said court, quote, will not fix upon isolated statements of the trial judge taken out of the full context in which they were made and used them as a predicate for holding the law has been misapplied. Now, in this case, you have this one remark, and the defendant is basically harping on it. It's interesting because at trial he never said anything about it, and if he had, the trial judge might have said, well, all I meant by that was, and make a clarifying comment, but he was not afforded that opportunity. But consistent with what I've just read from Yarborough, you have to look not just at this one comment, but what followed it. The comment, again, is a page that he relies on so heavily. It's at page 400 of the appendix. It says so we have to have some evidence he actually intended to kill certain people, and so we don't have any evidence before the jury that he specifically intended to kill any person individually. That's the focal point of the argument. Very next sentence. The only evidence the court believes we have is that he basically intended to kill the people who were there. But that's not the only thing relevant to an assessment of what the judge meant by that.
Can I ask you this and tell me what I'm missing here? Why does it matter? Why are we even having this conversation? Suppose the judge said at a motion to strike, I personally don't believe there's sufficient evidence here for the case to go forward, but I'm going to deny the motion to strike. Sorry. And it goes to a jury, and a jury finds the evidence sufficient and convicts him. Why would it matter to us? The only issue is, was it sufficient at the time of conviction? And the inconsistent or wrong or right remark of the trial judge is beside the point because the trial judge denied the motion to strike. I see a systemic flaw in the argument that requires me not even to think through what was said. It doesn't matter to me.
I would agree with that, Justice Kelsey, with the one obvious caveat that, of course, if on appeal the appellate court concluded the evidence was insufficient.
Well, then it wouldn't matter what the trial judge said. We would just say the jury found the evidence sufficient and we don't agree. You can't piece together the evidence.
That's true, and I would agree with that. But just to take the argument on its own terms, whether in fact that showed that the judge's analysis of the facts meant that the case, according to him, the count should be dismissed. He says, the judge, very next page of the transcript, bottom of page 401, of the appendix. He could certainly intend to kill in different ways, and he could intend to kill any one of these persons. And, for example, if there's evidence, for example, that really had an axe to grind against Abraham Kay, who was one of the residents of the commune, and I really wanted to burn him alive, whether Abraham Kay was there or not, it would make no difference. But we don't have any evidence from which he has any specific animus against any one of these individual people from what I've heard. The evidence could certainly lead the jury to infer that he had some problem collectively with the individuals, and I think at most the evidence rises to the point where he wanted to basically set on fire and kill the people who were there. My construction of what I've just said is that the judge said, I don't really see any evidence here that of the attempted murder victims that he had any particular hostility as to any one or two of them. What he said was there was certainly evidence that he wanted to set a fire in such a way and at such a time as to kill all of them. I would submit that that is an unremarkable proposition and certainly is a far cry from the significance that counsel attaches to it. A couple other things on that before I move to the confession issue. First, I've made a fairly elaborate default argument, which I'm not going to go through. I would point out that a close reading of the motion to strike, I think, shows two arguments were before the court, neither one of which is anything along the lines of what we're talking about now. The first one was basically a test almost fashioned by the trial judge, but defense counsel never ever suggested any disagreement with it. In fact, he seemed to say, you're right, and at the very least, he acquiesced in it. And that test, one that the judge mentioned several times, was whether or not the person in the indictment was in the building at the time the fire was set. If they were, he denied the motion to strike. If they weren't, he granted it. And in some ways, that benefited the defendant because there was a resident who clearly, under his own testimony, lived in the residence upstairs where this fire occurred. Jason, I forget his last name. And by his testimony, at 4:45 in the morning, he was having trouble sleeping, and he went outside to have a cigarette 100, 200 feet away. And when he came back, he almost instantly saw the fire erupting. And the judge granted the motion to strike as to him on the ground that he hadn't literally been in the building at the time the fire was started. I'm not sure I agree with that, but the point is that certainly inured to the defendant's benefit under that approach. The only other argument in the motion to strike was, did the defendant's acts rise above general malevolence? Because if they didn't, that would not support a specific intent crime such as attempted murder. And there are arguments that he didn't really intend to kill the people. As I understand counsel's answer today in response to Justice Kelsey's question about, well, what if the judge had not made this remark that they're emphasizing, would you still argue that there was not enough evidence to support the counts? And my understanding is he said, I would not make that argument. So it seems to me one of the two arguments raised at trial seems to have been abandoned. Now, on the confession issue, counsel starts out with Elstad, and obviously the two primary cases that the court would be concerned with are Elstad and Siebert, although Kuhn would be the main state case that basically addressed the impact of both of them. And counsel started out with Elstad and talking about this careful and thorough administering of rights. I would point out parenthetically that at any number of points in the arguments on the motion to suppress, that defense counsel said this case fell much closer, was much more in line with the issues in Holding and Siebert than it was in Elstad, which I take to mean he was implicitly conceding he had a weaker argument on the merits under Elstad. But in any event, he both today and in his brief has talked about this careful and thorough administering of rights. A couple of points in connection with that. There's never been any claim, any showing that the reading of the rights was in itself deficient, that they were in any way wrong or incomplete. And the other thing is that the warning given in Elstad is exactly the same here, with one exception. In each case, the officer read from a pre-printed recitation of the rights. So do you understand them? Yes, and they proceeded. The only difference is the defendant in Elstad was 18. The defendant here was 1 month short of 27. So if there was a careful administering and thorough administering of the rights in Elstad, I submit that the same conclusion surely obtains here. Now, I think as I understand it, counsel concedes that Justice Kennedy's approach, which dispensed with any objective inquiry and focused on the subjective intent of the police officer, is the narrower ground and the one that this court should apply. I would submit that the findings of fact here are fatal to any notion of this deliberate employment of this two-step strategy. You have to remember, first of all, the circumstances under which the questioning occurred. This agent, excuse me, Lozera, had been at the scene in Louisa County most of the day trying to determine the origin of the fire, and then was driving back late that afternoon to Richmond to, I guess, process some of the evidence that had been obtained there. And he's, I think, already back in Richmond and starting to do that. and he gets a call from another agent, Robert, saying that Secret is now back at the commune. And Lazier expressed some interest in talking with him and said, you know, it would be better if we could do it at the sheriff's office. And that made perfect sense because, for one thing, Secret had been in the woods all day, he's cold and wet, and there were any number of Acorn residents that, by the time the first officer came on the scene, they were basically menacing him in a semicircle. They obviously were not too happy with what they thought he had done in the case. So when he was asked, do you want to, would you be willing to go talk with this agent at the Louisa County Sheriff's Office, quite understandably, he said, yep. And in fact, on their brief, they say he assented to doing that. And so this is not a typical, the dynamics surrounding this interview at the sheriff's office are atypical. There's all sorts of reasons why even the defendant would be happy to be there. But in any event, Lazier turns around, having just gotten back to Richmond, drives to Louisa County, and by this point it's 6:45, and he's talked with this agent Roberts, who he makes clear in his testimony he trusts him implicitly, and he certainly understood from him that Secret had willingly and voluntarily gone there. So it is quite understandable that when he got there, he did not know that the defendant, legally speaking, was in custody, and that he acted in good faith in not giving him the Miranda warnings. That is a factual finding. The Court of Appeals in Kuhn made clear it's a factual finding. It's plainly supported by the record. It's plainly not wrong to the point that the factual findings can be set aside.
Mr. Anderson, there are some courts that seem to have made a two-part test, subjective and objective test, to determine whether the detective's questioning was deliberate. And I think they were mostly decided after Kuhn. Does it appear that the trial court here engaged, and should this court have any interest in that, does it appear that the trial court here engaged in that two-part test that's expressed in the Second Circuit case, and I think the Fourth Circuit has adopted it, or did it just subjectively say the officer appears to be honest, he didn't know about the two-step process, didn't engage in a two-step process?
I certainly think the latter was the crux of the matter. If I understand Your Honor's references, you may be referring to several cases cited mostly from federal courts talking about
correct.
That there was not a significant passage of time between the giving of the Miranda warning and then the resumption, the same officer being the one to do the questioning.
Yes. So
the problem with those cases is that they fly in the face of explicit language from Elstad and Justice Kennedy's concurring opinion, concurring in the judgment, by the way, not simply concurring. In Elstad, by the way, the state court had relied upon similar circumstances, no break in time, etc. Elstad pointed out that this requirement of some break, some passage of time, whatever, has been in the context of the Fourth Amendment violations, which is a constitutional violation. So that's the first thing. They also said, if I can find my little flags, they say at one point, talking about other courts, the majority have explicitly or implicitly recognized that Westover, which is a Supreme Court case, requirement of a break in the stream of events is an apposite. In these circumstances, a careful and thorough administration of Miranda warning serves to cure the condition that rendered the statement inadmissible. They then go on to say, a handful of courts, however, have applied our precedents related to confessions obtained under coercive circumstances to situations involving wholly voluntary admissions, requiring a passage of time or break-in events before a second fully warned statement can be deemed voluntary. Far from establishing a rigid rule, we direct courts to avoid one. And there's other language to this effect, that if you have an initial voluntary statement with what we'll call a technical Miranda violation, those requirements are not part of the mix. And I know I'm, well, I've got one. And Justice Kennedy, in his concurring opinion, in a similar way.
Your time has expired.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson.
Your time has expired.
Oh, I'm sorry, I misread the clock. I'm sorry. Thank you.
Rebuttal.
Miranda warnings that are delivered midstream in verbiage that anticipates further conversation and only a verbal waiver is obtained before starting interrogation less than a minute later, that we submit to this court is not a careful and thorough administration of Miranda warnings when Lazier is then in a position to have to cure a Fifth Amendment violation.
Well, that holding, if we were to say that, is far beyond what Kennedy's concurrence stated. Now, we can do that, and I'm sure there are plenty of courts who are inclined to want to do that, but that's what we'd have to do.
Actually, Your Honor, we're arguing in this regard under ELSTAT itself that the failure to carefully administer Miranda warnings, the failure to do careful and thorough administration of Miranda warnings. But
that case is a voluntariness case. And Siebert is a presumed involuntariness case on Miranda. I mean, it would be even a stronger departure, I would argue, to go to pure voluntariness under this fact pattern.
Your Honor,
I don't even think the plurality in Siebert would have done that.
Absent a careful and thorough administration of the warnings, the constitutional violation cannot be cured, coupled with the exploitive conduct that Lazier engaged in the continuum of interrogation. My time has expired.
Thank you for your argument. Call the next case.